This is KGNU's Morning Magazine for Friday, July 30th. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, the CDC's moratorium on evictions is set to expire tomorrow. We'll look at what that means within the context of a pandemic that is still active. The main provider of services to Boulder's homeless population says it's rescinding its six-month city residency requirement to access those services. That's after the ACLU of Colorado warned the city of Boulder its move-along approach to homelessness is unconstitutional. And we'll hear the results of the longest-running study of tree mortality in Colorado, linking increasing rates of subalpine tree death to warmer and drier summers. At 8:30 this morning, Connections comes your way. As always, you can connect with the crew and their guests by calling into the studio. Then at 9:30, the Morning Sound Alternative will start your weekend off right with an eclectic mix of music until noon. All that is still coming up, but first, these headlines with KGNU's Stacey Johnson.
The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill which would turn Amanchi, a former Japanese-American internment camp located near the Colorado town of Granada, into a National Historic Site. The legislation, co-sponsored by Colorado Congressman Joe Neguse and Ken Bunk, moves on to the U.S. Senate. The measure received broad bipartisan support, with only two votes against it in the House. Between 1942 and 1945, the U.S. government removed 120,000 Japanese Americans and Japanese nationals from their homes on the West Coast and imprisoned them in so-called internment camps. The Amanchi Camp, also known as the Granada Relocation Center, located in southeast Colorado, held around 10,000 prisoners of Japanese ancestry, including entire families with small children. Amanchi was one of 10 internment camps in the country. More than 20,000 Coloradans will soon receive checks in the mail from CenturyLink. Steve Miller has more.
The money comes from a 2019 settlement that the Colorado Attorney General's office reached with CenturyLink because the company deceptively overcharged consumers for services. An investigation by the Consumer Protection Division in the Colorado Department of Law uncovered evidence dating back to 2014 that CenturyLink unfairly and deceptively charged hidden fees, falsely advertised guaranteed-to-locked prices, and failed to provide discounts and refunds it promised to consumers in Colorado. As part of the settlement, CenturyLink refunded $1.7 million directly to consumers for overbilling errors before March 31, 2020. CenturyLink also paid nearly $7 million to the state of Colorado for violating consumer protection laws. Those funds will be distributed to those consumers affected by CenturyLink's deceptive conduct. The settlement required CenturyLink to change its business practices and explain clearly its pricing terms, including fees and surcharges, in its advertising and sales. The company also agreed to stop charging an internet cost recovery fee for future orders and to stop charging unreturned equipment fees to consumers who return equipment on time. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
Aurora Police Officer John Hobart, who is facing assault and felony charges, submitted his letter of resignation on Wednesday. Body cam video shows Hobart choking and hitting a man with his gun upon arrest for a trespassing event that occurred on July 23rd. On Tuesday, Hobart was arrested and is due in Arapahoe County District Court on August 9th for a bond hearing. According to the Colorado Sun, the internal investigation of the incident will continue, and Aurora Police Chief Vanessa Wilson will make her decision public as to what discipline Hobart would have faced. The old campus of Fort Lewis College in Hesperus and the defunct Teller Indian School in Grand Junction will be investigated for remains of Native children who attended the institutions. The investigations come after the discovery of 215 unmarked graves at an indigenous boarding school in Canada. During last week's news conference in Denver, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland announced that the U.S. government will assist local communities in identifying and investigating potential unmarked graves. The Denver Post reports tribal leaders are being consulted to determine the most culturally sensitive way to go about the investigations and to respect those most impacted by the tragic history. Two organizations that are at odds over the future of Denver's Park Hill Golf Course have gained approval for their respective measures to be on the upcoming November citywide ballot. According to Colorado Public Radio's Denverite, the two ballot initiatives will attempt to change laws regarding the conservation easement of the golf course that has been established since 1997. Westside Investment Partners, which bought the golf course in 2019, wants to build a mixed-use development on the land with some park space, while the group SOS Denver wants all the space turned into a park. If the SOS Denver's initiative passes, Denver residents will have to give approval through a citywide vote to end a conservation easement and any development, while the developer's initiative will attempt to exempt the golf course land on a technicality defining a conservation easement. And weather today, it is expected to be mostly sunny with a high near 93, and we're looking at a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms after 1 p.m. Tonight, showers and thunderstorms are likely before 10 p.m. Right now, outside our Boulder studios, it is 70 degrees. For KGNU, this is Stacy Johnson.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. The CDC's eviction moratorium ends tomorrow. Housing rights advocates warn the end of the moratorium may mark the start of a new wave of homelessness nationwide.
So how did we get to this point? The root of the problem is the unavailability of affordable housing.
That's sociologist Peter Hepburn of Princeton University's Eviction Lab speaking at a recent webinar.
Rents have increased dramatically over the last several decades, while wages have remained stagnant, especially for low-wage workers. Prior to the pandemic, almost half of renter households were categorized as housing cost burdened, which means that they spend more than 30% of their income on rent. A quarter spent more than half of their income on housing, and those shares are far higher for low-income households. Housing choice vouchers could, in theory, help, but only one in four eligible households actually receive them. Margins are really thin when you're devoting that much of your income to housing. And the typical renter has little or nothing in savings, no sort of private safety net to see them through in the event of a job loss or an unexpected medical bill. The failure to pay rent is by far the most common cause of eviction, and the amounts in question typically aren't all that large.
Experts with the Eviction Lab warn that zip codes with the highest rates of eviction filings also tend to have low vaccination rates. Law professor Emily Benfer of the Wake Forest Law Health Justice Clinic says lifting the eviction moratorium during a surge in cases of the Delta variant represents a significant public health risk.
This is because without vaccinations, the end of the moratoria are strongly associated with the increased COVID-19 incidence and mortality. During the summer of 2020, in a study led by Dr. Kate Leifheit at UCLA, we compared the states that lifted their moratoria with those that did not. And after controlling for stay-at-home orders, mask orders, school closures, temperature, and other factors, we found that lifting moratoria results in a 2.1 times higher incidence and a 5.4 times higher COVID-19 mortality. Nationally, these results translated to a total of 433,700 excess cases and 10,700 excess deaths associated with eviction moratoriums lifting just during the summer of 2020. The mortality rate is likely more pronounced because the people at the greatest risk of eviction are also more likely to have health conditions that place them at increased risk of hospitalization and death if they contract COVID-19.
Professor Benfer says that beyond the pandemic, greater protections for renters and the expansion of rental assistance are necessary public health measures.
Eviction negatively affects every area of a person's life and results in a cycle of poor health and economic and housing instability. As you can see, eviction is associated with severe and several disabling conditions, including higher mortality, coronary heart disease, and just the risk of eviction itself, just that notice of eviction is associated with anxiety, depression, exposure to violence and mental health hospitalization and suicide. For women, it is particularly harmful in that it is associated with physical and sexual assault and future housing precarity, which means that once you receive the first eviction filing, you're likely to see more after that. And eviction is particularly traumatizing for children. It's associated with emotional trauma, lead poisoning, and the permanent brain damage it causes, food insecurity, academic decline, reduced life expectancy, taking years off their life. For children who are evicted while they are in the womb or when they are born, eviction results in low birth weight and preterm pregnancies. So in this way, eviction itself alters the entire life course for the worse.
One of the more extreme short-term results of eviction is homelessness. Homeless rights advocates warn that lifting the eviction moratorium may double Denver's unhoused population. While carrying out an accurate census of the homeless population can be tricky, many service providers say the number of people needing emergency housing outstrips the number of available shelter spaces. That's certainly the case in Boulder, where restrictions on accessing shelters are compounded by a 6-month residency requirement, something the American Civil Liberties Union of Colorado says is unconstitutional. The state chapter of the ACLU sent a letter yesterday to members of Boulder's city government and to Homeless Solutions of Boulder County. Hours later, Homeless Solutions of Boulder County informed the Boulder Daily Camera it intends to reverse its 6-month residency requirement next month. But the residency requirement was just one piece of the letter from the ACLU. Yesterday, I spoke with Annie Kurtz, the ACLU attorney behind the letter.
So we wrote to Boulder about two separate policies that impact unhoused residents there that are separate but interrelated. So the first is a residency requirement for shelter that basically says if you haven't lived in Boulder for 6 months when you try to access the shelter, you're ineligible for most shelter services, especially shelter services that include an overnight stay. So if you've only been in Boulder for 6 months when you try to go to the shelter, you may be eligible for a bus ticket out of town, help reunifying with a landlord, something short of shelter like that. But it basically unconstitutionally discriminates between newer and older Boulder County residents. And the U.S. Supreme Court has said time and time again that you can't condition vital government assistance like shelter on a length of residency. The second policy is Boulder's enforcement of its camping ban. And courts around the country have recognized that it's unconstitutional to punish people for sleeping outdoors when they have no meaningful alternative to that. And in Boulder, there are lots of reasons why people simply can't access the shelter. So one is the unconstitutional residency requirement that we were just talking about. Other reasons are lack of shelter space. With the pandemic, shelters had to limit capacity and homelessness has only increased. And Boulder actually cut homeless beds almost in half just last year. So we have a severe shortage of actual beds in Boulder for how many people are experiencing homelessness here. And then there are other reasons why people might not be able to access shelter, like they might have a mental health condition that is incompatible with crowded congregate settings, might have a pet, might be married, unable to stay with their partner overnight. Plenty of reasons people can't go to shelter, and it shouldn't be a crime for those people to sleep outdoors when that's their only option.
Do any other cities in the U.S. have a 6-month residency requirement for accessing services for the unhoused?
Not that I know of. I have heard that some other cities in Colorado are starting to look at Boulder, perhaps, as an example of what they might do. Which would certainly not be what we want to see, because it's definitely not a constitutional approach to this. But as far as I know, Boulder is the only place in the country doing this at the moment.
The ACLU of Colorado also recently won a significant case against Fort Collins. Can you go into that?
Sure. So in Fort Collins, our client was cited under that city's camping ban for sleeping overnight in his vehicle at a rest stop. because he couldn't go to either of the city's indoor shelters that night. He actually worked at one of the shelters. And so fraternization and safety rules prevented him from staying at either one. The shelters were also both full the night that he was cited. And the court held that under those circumstances, it violated the Constitution for Fort Collins to prosecute him for sleeping outside when he didn't have any other meaningful alternative. And it's significant for what's happening in Boulder, I think, because as that court recognized, there are reasons besides lack of capacity that people don't and can't go to shelter. And certainly those are very present in Boulder and a big concern.
As you write in your letter, the city has defended aggressive enforcement of its camping ban by citing the persistence of unused beds at Boulder Shelter for the Homeless, using that data to paint those on the streets as service resistant and voluntarily unhoused. What issue do you take with that argument?
As, you know, we could take the 6-month residency requirement as an example. Boulder has exclusionary policies that keep people out of shelter. And in fact, something I didn't mention before that I should have is if you've been in Boulder for less than 6 months and you try to access shelter, you're actually penalized by not being eligible for shelter for another 2 years after that. So, Boulder on the one hand is penalizing people for trying to access services. And on the other hand, justifying making it a crime for people to sleep outdoors and saying it's because they have no interest in accessing services. So, it's illogical, it's inconsistent, and ultimately it's inhumane.
The ACLU reviewed records from the Boulder Police Department, which you say basically supports your argument that this is unconstitutional. Why?
So in March, the chief of Boulder Police, Maris Harold, sent out a directive to all officers in the department with guidance about factors to consider before issuing a citation under the camping ban. And what's relevant to me is that none of those factors includes an inquiry into whether the person to be cited could possibly have gotten into shelter that night. And so if that's the key constitutional inquiry, and there's nothing that I found in the records request that I reviewed that requires officers to make that critical inquiry. That kind of enforcement it risks punishing people who in fact couldn't have gotten into the shelter that night, but the police would never know it.
Annie, is there anything else that you would like to add that I didn't touch on with my questions?
Yes, I would just like to say, Boulder prides itself on having been recognized 2 years in a row as the number one place to call home. And I just think that's true unless you're unhoused in Boulder. And I hope that Boulder changes its approach and tries to make Boulder a welcoming home for its unhoused residents as well.
That was Annie Kurtz, the ACLU of Colorado's Equal Justice Works Fellow. You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. Results of the longest-running study of tree mortality in Colorado were published earlier this year in the Journal of Ecology. KGNU's Hannah Lee Myers spoke to the study's lead author, Robert Andrus, a postdoctoral researcher at Washington State University, about what the findings show us about climate change's impact on forests in the Rocky Mountains.
So what our research is showing is that rates of tree mortality are increasing in Colorado subalpine forests, and this is in areas that don't have obvious disturbances like fire and bark beetle outbreaks. So what we showed was that higher rates of tree mortality are related to warmer and drier summer conditions. And so what we sort of expect from this is that, continued climate warming will continue to increase tree mortality throughout subalpine forests.
Okay, so you looked at the causes of tree deaths in areas not notably impacted by beetle outbreaks or fire. Got it. So give us a better idea of how significant an increase you found in tree deaths caused by drought and heat in those areas that weren't notably impacted by those other factors?
In those types of forests, mortality is generally pretty low, so maybe 0.5 to 2% per year. And what we're showing is that there was a 3 times increase in mortality in these forests from a time period in the 80s and early 90s to a more recent time period from 2008 to 2019. So what we found in this study was that 70% of the trees had no evidence of other causes of death than drought and temperature-related evidence. So, and then 23% of the trees that we sampled, they had evidence of bark beetle damage. So they've been attacked by bark beetles. So in many of Colorado's forests, bark beetles, are there fairly continuously, and they attack and kill the more weakened trees. And then occasionally, when climate conditions align with, the right types of trees and the right sizes of trees, then we can have these really broad scale outbreaks of bark beetle. The other important point here is that there are many factors that cause tree death. So you might have warmer and drier conditions that stress the trees out and make them more susceptible to bark beetles. Or you may just have a situation where warmer and drier conditions decrease the soil moisture to the point where the trees don't have enough moisture to maintain their physiological processes, and they die just as a result of climate. In this study, our goal is not to show that bark beetle outbreaks or fire are not having an important effect. They're most definitely having a very important effect. And those disturbances are driven by warmer and drier conditions as well. What our point in this study is that, outside of those areas affected by those disturbances, we're also showing really important effects of warmer and drier conditions on forests as well. So in those forests where people walk around and they say, oh, there's a dead tree and there's one more, and they walk another half a mile and they say, oh, there's a dead tree, we're saying that, that mortality is related to climate. So our goal is not to try to one up the papers that have looked at disturbance, of which, I've written some, and a lot of my colleagues have also written a lot of great papers. Those are, we're not trying to say that this is more important. Our point is that that mortality in those areas not affected by disturbances is also affected by climate.
So what varieties of trees are most impacted by heat and drought?
Yeah, so what we found was that subalpine fir was the most common tree species to die, and it died at the highest rates. In a lot of our stands, subalpine fir died much more frequently than Engelmann spruce. We also included a bunch of stands that had limber pine and lodgepole pine as well. So we generally found that the pine species were less susceptible to drought and warmer conditions than Engelmann spruce.
What areas in Colorado have notable concentrations of those heat and drought susceptible species?
Yeah, so Engelmann spruce and subalpine fir forests cover roughly 10,000 square miles in Colorado. And of that 10,000 square miles, some of the area also includes limber pine and lodgepole pine, which were included in this study. So the highest elevation forests in Colorado are subalpine forests. Or those are the areas where people often go hiking if they're going up into the alpine, or they go skiing. So they are all over the state of Colorado and up into southern Wyoming and northern part of New Mexico. So people have likely, walked through Engelmann spruce and subalpine fir forest in Colorado. And, this study was done in the Colorado Front Range, north of Nederland at the CU Mountain Research Station. But the results are generally applicable to, subalpine forests in Colorado.
Tell us about the connection between your findings in this study and the future of carbon sequestration.
Forests are an important carbon sink. And what we show in this study is that the rates of tree mortality for larger and older trees are increasing much more rapidly than smaller and younger trees. And as we're seeing an increase in mortality for these larger and older trees that store the most carbon, this is sort of the alarm bell going off saying, hey, we might be seeing some pretty, important changes in our subalpine forests and their ability to serve as a carbon sink in the future.
And what do you think the response to this study should be?
Yeah, I think that, the important message here is that, climate change is having an important effect on our forests in the Southern Rockies. And people often point to things like sea level rise as the most obvious, effect of climate change. But, we're seeing more fires, maybe potentially larger fires, broad-scale outbreaks from bark beetles and all these sort of things, you know, illustrating that climate change is having a really important effect on the forests. And in this study, we show that even outside of those disturbances, we're seeing really important effects of climate change. So, yeah, we just need to be aware that that's happening, and we need to, you know, change our behavior so that we can potentially reduce the impacts of climate change and adapt to those changes.
And that was Robbie Andrus, a postdoctoral researcher in forest ecology at Washington State University and author of a new study showing increasing rates of subalpine tree mortality in Colorado linked to warmer and drier climates. For KGNU, I'm Hanalee Myers.
And that's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Special thanks to Stacey Johnson, Steve Miller, Rosanna Longo-Better, and Hanalee Myers for their work on today's program.